in 2 hours or less. In addition to HEB curbside and home delivery, shoppers can use Favor's new Express Delivery service. With Express Delivery, customers can choose up to 25 items from a selected list of groceries. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.com.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 57 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, Recording Library volunteers and staff dig into past editions of the National Magazine of Texas.
Whose Super Bowl wins? 5 Super Bowl appearances, 18 playoff appearances, and an NFL record 20 consecutive winning seasons.
Next, representing the management of the Dallas Cowboys, the president and general manager, Texas E. Schramm.
Bob Lilly, number 74, was the foundation on which the Dallas Doomsday defense was built, playing defensive tackle at a level previously unseen in the NFL.
What is ice ball? What was it? For someone who doesn't know football, has never heard of the game.
What is the ice
what
bowl?
What is it? Yeah.
Okay, it's American football. It was the coldest game ever played. Somebody froze to death in the stands. The players' fingers all froze. They couldn't get their cleats to go into the ground. And it was as cold as it is at the North Pole. Oh, and it was against the mighty Green Bay Packers.
This has left a big scar on Don, and I think Don has suffered more from this because he feels it's a quarterback's job to lead the team to victory, and he felt that he's sincerely failed the team the last 2 years losing to Green Bay. Of course, we don't agree with this.
My dad played one more season with the Cowboys, then decided to retire at the age of 31.
We won for 20 years in a row as far as winning, and 19 of those years were in the playoffs. When we were in the locker room after Super Bowl VI, I felt, this is Don Meredith's team. He should be here.
He had an unbelievable change of direction.
That's what made Roger great. He would feel you coming, and he would just spin out like he had eyes in the back of his head.
He is going to
close.
Will Pierce that? He got it. Touchdown. I can go in the head for a while. Got the ball back. I don't believe it. He just threw the ball over the scoreboard. I don't believe it. The ball was thrown short, and the defender was not watching, and Pearson came back to make the catch for it.
Hi, this is Jack. Here's an article from the August 1997 issue of Texas Monthly entitled, Turn Out the Lights. My night at the Dallas Cowboys old-timers reunion is over, but it left me wondering why Don Meredith didn't show up, whether Tom Landry deserved his reputation as a coaching genius, and where America's team went wrong. I recognized Alicia Landry as soon as she walked into the party, but I had to get closer before identifying the man with her as her husband. Tom Landry seemed to have shrunk. Either that or the floor was tilting. The 72-year-old founding coach of the Dallas Cowboys appeared surprisingly frail and stooped, as though he carried on his back the wreckage of countless careers and ambitions. For the first time in the 30-odd years I had known him, Tom looked his age. So did a surprising number of people at the Dallas Cowboys old-timers reunion. The idea for the reunion had originated with the wives of such former Cowboys as Leroy Jordan, Tony Licio, Don McElhaney, and Jerry Tubbs. For me, the party came at an auspicious time. Once, the Cowboys had been a big part of my life. From 1963 to 1967, I covered the team on a regular basis for the Dallas Morning News. And since then, I've written dozens of magazine articles about them. Like so many fans, though, I've had about all I can take of the Jerry Jones, Barry Switzer, Michael Irvin, Leon Lett follies. It was easy to love the teams of the 60s and 70s. They had an unspoiled innocence, even a certain nobility. That began to degenerate in the 80s and nosedived into abject depravity by the 90s. Apparently others have the same feeling. Two new books looking at the early Cowboys, Cowboys Have Always Been My Heroes by Peter Golenbach, and Cotton Bowl Days by John Eisenberg, are scheduled for publication in August, just as the current team will be staggering into its uncertain future. Still, when I got my invitation to the reunion, I wasn't sure that I should go. Some of the things I'd written about the Cowboys were critical, and some complimentary, but I knew from experience that while the players and coaches might forget the criticism, the wives never would. Sure enough, shortly after I arrived, Alicia Landry approached me while Tom stopped to chat with a couple of old players. "I hope you're not going to write anything nasty about us," she said in a stage whisper. Before the evening ended, two more wives made remarks similar to Alicia's. "Sorry, ladies. One of the predictable things about reunions is that everyone falls back into old roles." The old-timers reunion was limited to players, coaches, and staff, and a few sports writers who had been part of the coming-of-age years, 1960 to 1980, 2 decades in which the team emerged from a ragtag group of cast-offs that nobody took seriously into the most fabled franchise in sports. The site was The Ranch, a party barn near the Dallas Convention Center, decorated for this occasion with blue and white balloons and banners that looked curiously dated. So did the players themselves. Most of them wore the same kinds of boots and western cut shirts they had worn 30 years ago, in keeping with the country and western theme. This was strictly a family affair, with children and grandchildren predominating. Nothing makes you feel old as meeting the grandchild of a contemporary. One section of the room was lighted as a makeshift photographer's studio, where family groups took turns posing for pictures. On the opposite side of the large open room, a western swing band played tunes that were familiar and easy for dancing. Families helped themselves to generous heaps of barbecue, beans, and potato salad. The cast of characters whose nighttime escapades led teammate Pete Gent to write North Dallas 40s could not have been more sober or low-key. In the dim light of the party room, worn eyes squinted to read name tags. Arthritic hands reached out to greet old friends, and reconstructed knees tried gamely to do the cotton-eyed Joe. At every table and in every group, tales of small defeats, near misses, and glorious triumphs gained nuances with each telling. At the bar, I ran into Tex Schramm, the executive who put together 5 Super Bowl teams and created the image of America's team. Over the years, I'd run into Tex countless times at countless bars, and our conversations had been unfailingly stimulating. But tonight, for some reason, talk was flat and awkward. We were forced to confront how much had passed, not only time, but also the Cowboys' magic. Yet, I heard not a word about the current Cowboys at the party. There was no common bloodline. Looking around the room, I allowed random memories to surface in my consciousness. Pettus Norman, an unknown second-year tight end, deeply absorbed in a Bible, taking a solitary stroll at twilight across the campus of the training camp in Marquette, Michigan. Defensive tackle Rocky Colvin, pounding his fist into a steel locker in the Cotton Bowl dressing room, getting mentally ready for a game against the Giants. Bob Lilly, the Cowboys' first Hall of Famer, and his morning dove-hunting parties, drinking cases of beer and firing at dragonflies or anything else that moved. that charter flight home after a big win in New York in 1965, when rookie Bob Hayes' 2 touchdown receptions gave Dallas the right to participate in its first postseason game in Miami. And the stricken look on Landry's face when Hayes, fortified by champagne, got on the airplane intercom and sang "Moon Over Miami." Watching Tex return to his table, I noticed that he walked with a slow shuffle, his dancer's poise gone with time. I spotted Leroy Jordan, the great linebacker, across the room. Most of his hair had turned silver. Most of Jim Becky's hair had vanished. Cornell Green, in my memory, the ultimate warrior, a cornerback lithe and ribboned with muscle, had gone to lard. It's the fourth quarter for all of us. Even the great Lily appeared somewhat enfeebled. "When there's a chill in the air," Lily complained, "my lungs ache and my fingers sting like someone is driving nails through them." This is a legacy of playing in the 13 below zero conditions of the 1967 NFL championship game in Green Bay, forever to be known as the Ice Bowl. A number of Cowboys were treated for frostbite that day, and all of them have similar complaints. "Anytime the temperature drops below 40 degrees," Jethro Pugh said, "my hands and feet feel like they're on fire." Leroy Jordan remembered that when the mercury had dropped during a hunting trip a few years ago, the pain got so severe that he actually cried in front of his son. There were essentially 2 groups of players in the room: those from the Don Meredith era, 1960 to 68, and those from the Roger Staubach era, 1969 to 79. And they didn't mingle. A few, such as Lilly and Jordan, bridged the gap, having played under the leadership of both quarterbacks. The difference between the two groups, aside from age, is that those who played with Staubach wear Super Bowl rings, while those who played with Meredith missed out on 2 rings by a total of 2 yards. Football, the cliche goes, is a game of inches. The Staubach group congregated near the front of the party room, where Roger, his wife, and Tom and Alicia Landry sat. Near the back of the room, out of the limelight, as always, were offensive linemen Becky and Licio, along with Colvin and several other veterans of the 60s. They laughed about the time that Meredith bought drinks for the entire team at a posh hotel in Miami and signed Tex Schramm's name. Meredith's enduring popularity and his toughness and resiliency of spirit were the subject of many a conversation, but the key ingredient was missing: Meredith himself. Perhaps it would have been a different party if he had been in attendance, but nobody there had seen him for a long time. A number of old teammates wrote Meredith a few weeks before the reunion urging him to attend, but they never heard back. "I question if he ever got my letter," one lamented, shaking his head in despair. "I've heard that his wife Susan pretty much runs his affairs." Others have heard the same story, that Dandy Don's third wife is so protective that even agents and movie producers have tired of trying to contact him. In his day, the most gregarious and approachable of the Cowboys, Meredith has become a recluse. Financially secure, he lives half the year in Palm Springs, California, half in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He gives out no address, just a post office box and a fax number. When former Governor Ann Richards and her friend Bud Schrake visited him last winter in Santa Fe, Meredith appeared in good health, but his notoriously spindly legs were so fragile that he required a pair of $2,000 custom-made shoes to walk straight. Meredith gives no interviews, responds to no queries, disdains the card show circuit, and makes almost no personal appearances. But it's not the physical damage that causes him to shun the spotlight. It's the damage to his psyche. 9 bittersweet seasons in Dallas apparently have changed him. Meredith made a rare public appearance last December, signing autographs at a Kmart in New York as a favor to his friend, Kmart chairman Floyd Hall. he told a New York Times reporter. I don't miss the limelight, not at all. I'm just more comfortable out of it. He had long since stopped answering to the name Dandy Don. Dandy is somebody else, he told the reporter, no doubt plaintively. He wasn't a bad guy. A couple of hours into the party, Landry began to look at his watch, and someone whispered to the photographer to get cracking on the official reunion photograph. When players, coaches, and staff were asked to take their places on the makeshift bleachers prepared for the occasion, the irrepressible Hollywood Henderson nudged his way around several players and slid into the seat next to Landry. Tom tried his best to smile. Henderson threw both arms around the startled coach's neck and plopped his legs into Landry's lap. Tom's face appeared on the verge of cracking, but not into a smile. My wife and I left behind Tom and Alicia. I'm glad I went, but I don't think I want to do it again. Perhaps the reason that Meredith's failure to show up cast such a pall on the party, as if the class president hadn't attended the high school reunion, is that it reminded everyone of his unexpected and premature decision to retire after the 1968 season. It still haunts and puzzles these Cowboys because it robbed them of their destiny to become the game's finest team. In 1966 and again in 1967, under Meredith's leadership, the Cowboys lost the NFL championship to the Green Bay Packers in the final seconds. In retrospect, these two near misses reflected the growing pains of a still immature franchise. But at the time, they devastated the Cowboys and prompted some finger-pointing and blame-shifting. As usual, Meredith was the designated goat. A hometown boy who twice played to All-American honors at Southern Methodist University, Meredith was the first big name to sign with the Cowboys. He got a 5-year contract for $150,000, an enormous amount of money in 1960, and Dallas fans, being ranked novices to the pro football experience, assumed that it guaranteed the team and the quarterback instant success. When they realized how dreadfully wrong they had been, that first Cowboy team went 0-11-1, they took it out on Meredith. No athlete in Dallas has ever been so maligned and abused by fans, sports writers, including myself, and even coaches. John Eisenberg, a sports columnist for the Baltimore Sun who followed the Cowboys as a kid growing up in Plano, writes in Cotton Bowl Days, "Someone had to serve as a laboratory rat as the city developed the harder edge that came with the pros. It was Meredith's destiny to become the sacrificial figure on whom Dallas lost its innocence as a sports town." Meredith set the tone for the 60s. Playing with pain and an incredible assortment of injuries, shouldering the blame for defeats, deflecting the credit for success, defying and mocking Landry's somber, bloodless approach to the game. Meredith had more fun playing the game than anyone I ever saw, and it made it fun for the rest of us, former running back Dan Reeves, now the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons, told me after the reunion. Landry used to lecture his players on the subject of character, which he claimed was gained through adversity. But time after time, when adversity visited the Cowboys during a game, Landry pulled Meredith from crucial situations. Football stopped being fun for Meredith when Landry removed him from the 1968 playoff game against Cleveland after a couple of interceptions. The interceptions were not Meredith's fault. He was following the keys that Landry had given him, believing that the Browns' defense would react in a certain way, and if he threw to the right spot, the pass would be completed for a handsome gain. Unfortunately, the Browns failed to cooperate with Landry's game plan, and Landry rewarded Meredith's faith with a spot on the bench. Meredith shouldn't even have played in that game, Bob Lilly told me in a telephone interview following the party. He had just gotten out of the hospital with a punctured lung. He didn't have a very good game, but then none of us did. The players felt that Tom should have defended him. But Tom got so focused on the game, he didn't know if a player was ever hurt or not. When Meredith went to Landry's office to tender his resignation after the season, he fully expected and desperately wanted Landry to reject it. The quarterback was only 31, just reaching his prime. After years of building, the Cowboys were finally putting all the pieces together. The offensive line was respectable. The defense was the best in the league. Meredith was comfortable with Landry's multiple set offense and had mastered the art of picking apart a defense, and the players loved and trusted him. But Tom made no attempt to change Meredith's mind. Instead, he said, "Don, I think you've made the right decision." No blitzing linebacker ever crushed Dandy Don Meredith the way Tom Landry did. As things worked out, Landry was able to replace Meredith the following year with a 27-year-old rookie named Roger Staubach. After a couple of seasons of sharing time with Craig Morton, Staubach got Dallas its first Super Bowl championship. Had Meredith elected to keep on playing, Staubach, as he has been the first to admit, probably would have left for a less talented team, not content to be a backup. Game of inches, right? Say Landry had made the tiniest effort to talk Meredith out of retirement. Everything might have been different. Meredith might have been front and center at the 1997 old-timers reunion, and Roger Staubach would have been the answer to a trivia question. Cowboys fans got to know Meredith mostly through the media, and the media often reflected Landry's point of view. Meredith's congenital good humor was one of his many unique qualities the Cowboys coach was unable to appreciate. Landry viewed the game of football as a set of physical laws grounded on his own two innovations, the multiple set offense and the flex defense. In Tom's scheme of things, players were as interchangeable as the parts of a machine. As long as a quarterback could operate the multiple set offense, one player was no better or no worse than the other. Even after Staubach took over as the starter, Landry continued to juggle quarterbacks, with the result that the team sometimes panicked and lost confidence. The difference between Staubach and Meredith was that Roger never smiled when he talked back. What Landry found hard to accept in Meredith was exactly what made him so beloved by his teammates. No matter how grave a situation, he refused to lose his sense of humor. At the reunion, the old-timers told stories of how Dandy Don would waltz into the huddle singing a Willie Nelson song, or he would interrupt the snap count at the line of scrimmage and tell an opposing player like Redskins linebacker Sam Huff, "Hey Sam, you're in the wrong position." It was his way of saying, "Stay cool, baby." In the 1966 NFL Championship game, after the Packers jumped in front 14-0 before the Cowboys' offense ever got on the field, Meredith looked around at the grim faces in the first huddle and cracked, "Men, we're in a shitload of trouble." By halftime, the offense had responded with two touchdowns of its own, and the score was tied. Latter-day Cowboys no doubt had great respect for Staubach, but the feeling that the 60s Cowboys had for Dandy Don Meredith went way past respect. "We would have done anything for him," Becky told me. "Anything." I was a greenhorn 26-year-old sports writer in 1960 when both the Cowboys and the Dallas Texans of the AFL started up business. For the next 7 years, I covered pro football, first as the beat man following the Texans for the Dallas Times-Herald, 1960-62, then as the beat man following the Cowboys and a columnist for the Dallas Morning News. It was one hell of an education. My influence on the Cowboys was minimal, but not entirely nil. In 1964, I started writing about doomsday defense, for no particular reason except it sounded sexier than flex defense, and the name caught on. My counterpart at the Times-Herald, Steve Perkins, and I started a campaign to force Landry to move Mel Renfro from defensive back to offensive running back. Landry believed that Renfro's slight build couldn't take the pounding at running back. But our daily reports from training camp so fervently pleaded our cause, we called it MOO, short for Mel on Offense, that Landry finally relented. Unfortunately, in the season opener against the Giants, running back Renfro broke a bone in his foot. He subsequently returned to the defense, where he made the NFL Hall of Fame, and Perkins and I found something else to write about. When I left the Dallas in 1967, the Cowboys gave me a going-away party and a plaque, which is still on my bedroom wall. Mounted on the plaque is a kicking shoe, and engraved beneath the shoe are the words, "Just for Kicks," celebrating the time that I kicked a universally despised radio reporter down a flight of stairs at the Cowboys' headquarters on North Central Expressway. Although I remain, however grudgingly, a Cowboy fan, my favorite memories of the team are still of those years. Not just because I covered the team, but because I felt I was watching and absorbing sports drama. The Cowboys had great potential and great flaws, and you never knew which one was going to win out. When the Golombach and Eisenberg books arrived, I read them avidly to see if their recollections of the early years matched mine. Eisenberg's book, Cotton Bowl Days, paints an accurate and often moving portrait of the team, reflecting both the researching skill of a veteran sports writer — the author worked at the Times-Herald before moving to the Baltimore Sun — and the memories of a boy who grew up believing in God, country, and the Dallas Cowboys. From 1960 until the present, Cowboys football was a family affair for the Eisenbergs. John's grandfather, Pop, originally purchased 10 season tickets in 1960 and lorded it over them with patriarchal sway. Golombach's "Cowboys Have Always Been My Heroes" is a different matter. Though the book is billed as a definitive oral history of the Cowboys, the author's technique of running long, unchallenged quotes from former players, interspersed with just enough writer's narrative to move the story along, is anything but definitive. The oral history depends on interviews with a relative handful of players, and a disproportionate amount of the quotes on the turbulent 1965 season come from two infamous malcontents, Pete Gent and Buddy Dial. I should know, according to Golombach's book, one of the main things they were malcontent about was me. I remember the 1965 season all too well. It was a gut-wrenching roller coaster ride that carried the Cowboys to new lows and new highs. The team finished with a respectable 7-7 record, the first time in their six seasons that the Cowboys had not had a losing record, and earned a trip to a playoff game. But the ride was seldom pleasant. Landry benched Meredith unceremoniously during a losing streak and compounded his poor judgment by alternating two rookie quarterbacks, Craig Morton and Jerry Rome. After a fifth straight defeat in a hushed locker room in Pittsburgh, Landry broke into tears as he admitted to the team that perhaps the fault was his. Bob Lilly recalled the moment for me. "He just started to cry and nobody knew what to do. But we saw the real man that day. He was crying because he felt he had let us down. We never forgot that moment. It was the turning point for the Dallas Cowboys." A few days later, Landry pulled himself together and announced that Meredith would be his starter for the remainder of the season. But the team hadn't yet bottomed out. The Cowboys' moment that will live forever in infamy arrived a couple of weeks later in the Cotton Bowl against the defending NFL champion Cleveland Browns, with the first sellout crowd in Cowboy history looking on. Though the Cowboys were overmatched, they outplayed the Browns most of the game. Trailing by a touchdown with 83 seconds remaining, Dallas owned the ball on the Cleveland 1-yard line. 76,000 Cowboys fans were on their feet. After six seasons of frustration, their team was about to tie or beat the best team in the league. On first down, Meredith dropped back to pass, read the reactions of the defenders as Landry had taught him to do, and threw the ball straight to the Browns' middle linebacker. My game story in the Dallas Morning News the following day began with a takeoff on a famous passage written by Grant Rice after the 1924 Army-Notre Dame game. Outlined against a gray November sky, the four horsemen rode again Sunday. You know them, pestilence, death, famine, and Meredith. Glenbach devotes four pages of his book to the reaction of four Cowboy receivers, Gent, Dial, Frank Clark, and Pettis Norman, to my Four Horsemen story. All of them insist that the interception was Landry's fault, not Meredith's, and say that the players were so outraged by the story that in a team meeting they decided to give me a savage beating. Gent recalls, "We had a private team meeting without the coaches over Cartwright. They all wanted to kill him, and Meredith kept saying, 'You can't. It's his job. He's just doing his job like we're doing ours.'" Norman says the story was typical of the sour grape that really made the Gary Cartwright era in Dallas. Dial, the one-time Rice All-American, calls me a wormy little old devil who breathed an ill wind. There was no Gary Cartwright era, just as there was no beating. To settle a question of my alleged thrashing and determine once and for all who called the fatal play that November day in 1965, I checked newspaper stories of the time and telephoned several of the players on the team, including Lilly, Reeves, and Bob Hayes, as well as Landry. None of the players I spoke with remembered a team meeting or talk of physical violence against me. "No, that never happened," Lilly said. Now, Landry would come into the locker room with newspaper articles sometimes and say, "Here's a scathing article and it's true. That's where we are, right there." Reeves, who is now the dean of NFL coaches, remarked that Gent had often reworked facts to fit his own agenda, and said the controversial play, really and truly, that play wasn't Meredith's fault. He only had three plays to choose from in our goal line offense, two passes and a wedge where he hands off to the fullback going low over the top. In that case, I asked, shouldn't Landry have defended Meredith to the media? Reeves, who still refers to Tom as Coach Landry, paused for a moment then told me, "That's one of the things a coach has to consider when the quarterback is choosing the play." Landry didn't return my call, but in the dressing room interview published in the Morning News the day following the game, Landry made it clear that the play was Meredith's doing. Then he added, disingenuously, "I don't second-guess my quarterback." There was a phrase, also borrowed from Grant Rice, that you used to hear around the Cowboys' locker room after a losing game. It's not whether you win or lose, but who gets the blame. Many of the players quoted in Goldenbach's book, and Eisenberg's, are critical of Landry, not necessarily for the way he handled Meredith, but for the way he handled the entire team. "Even when we won, Tom Landry would go to the media, and you'd think we'd lost," says Cornell Green. Tom had trouble saying, "We played a good game." He had a problem with that. Even Leroy Jordan comes down hard on Tom. The players always had to take the blame for the losses. If Tom had a bad game plan or if he called a bad play, it was always the players' fault. Looking back, I realized that I allowed myself to become emotionally involved with the Cowboys. My reaction to a game was not much different from that of an ordinary fan, except I got to talk to the players and coaches before blowing off steam. At a downtown fan club luncheon a few days after the loss to the Browns, a hardcore fan asked Landry why the team allowed me to write such uncensored garbage. Landry replied, "You have to remember, when the game is over and we're all feeling terrible about losing, Gary is the one with the typewriter. I've always been grateful for Tom for understanding my role. I don't regret the Four Horsemen story, but I do regret writing in my column later that Meredith was a loser. I have committed a lot of stupid opinions to print, but none as stupid as that. Timothy McVeigh is a loser. Don Meredith was an extraordinarily gifted and complex man, at once whimsical and introspective, and no one ever worked harder or under more pain or pressure to prove himself as an athlete. Reading Goldenbach's book, I regretted all over again not getting straight my feelings for Meredith. Several players described flying home from Washington the week after the Four Horsemen episode. Meredith's daughter, Mary Donna, was sitting in his lap. Apparently overcome with a sense of failure, Don began crying and saying out loud, "I'm not a loser." I had never heard that story before, and reading it nearly brought tears to my eyes. After the 1965 season, I spent several days talking with Meredith for what was later a cover story in Sport magazine. It was as complimentary as the Four Horsemen had been abrasive. Meredith predicted that the Cowboys would continue to improve until they won more consistently than any team in history. The reason, he said, was Tom Landry. "I've learned one thing. Tom is right," he told me. "You get tired of a guy being so right so often, but that's the way it is. The hardest thing to do with Tom's system is believe it." After he retired, Meredith went on a binge of self-destruction, literally trying to kill himself. In "Cowboys Have Always Been My Heroes," Gent tells Goldenbach about a drugs and booze besotted trip that he and Meredith took to Baja California in 1969 as guests of the Janssen Swimwear Company. On the trip, Meredith insisted on swimming in shark-infested waters, challenged a cantina full of bad Mexicans to a fight, and rode his motorbike into a ravine, dislocating his shoulder and fracturing an arm. In a local hospital, he almost died from an overdose of morphine. "Unlike then," Gent says, "Meredith and the Cowboys were talking about his coming back for the 1970 season. Instead, Meredith became one of the stars of ABC's Monday Night Football and eventually made peace with his past." John Eisenberg traces the decline of the Dallas Cowboys as a team worth loving not to the arrival of Jerry Jones or the departure of Jimmy Johnson or to any other recent event, but to the abandonment of the Cotton Bowl in 1971. There is wonderful nostalgia in his recollections of the ratty old Cotton Bowl, a big concrete terrain, a Depression-era project incorporating none of the amenities that would become standard features. The bathrooms were little more than outhouses, hot in the summer and cold in the winter, and the stadium's general admission seats were separated from the reserved seats by strands of chicken wire. It was a blue-collar stadium where blue-collar fans watched a blue-collar team, which for five seasons lost many more games than it won. The concept of pro football as a social event didn't arrive in Dallas until 1971, Eisenberg reminds us, when Clint Murchison Jr. defied the civic leaders of Dallas and built Texas Stadium in suburban Irving. The Cowboys had always cultivated a mildly snobby character with their multiple-set offense, reliance on computers, and Landry's unemotional approach, he writes. But moving to Texas Stadium pushed their elitist reputation to a new zenith. In 1993, after Eisenberg's grandfather died, his 74-year-old father somehow forgot to mail the renewal for the family's season ticket allotment, which by then had dwindled to a single pair. The old man telephoned the Cowboys' office, certain that they would forgive the minor oversight from a family that had been ticket holders since 1960. A sharp-tongued assistant eventually renewed the seats, but warned him that he was on probation, and that if this ever happened again, his tickets would be forfeited. This was emblematic of the attitude searing pro football's soul, Eisenberg says. Teams no longer wanted fans. They wanted clients. It is impossible to compare the teams of my generation with the present Cowboys. Everything is different. The game, the expectations, the money, the fans, the owners, even the sports writers. If some of the old-timers thought I was a tough critic, how would they deal with Randy Galloway or the acerbic current crop of Dallas-Fort Worth talk show hosts? The self-commodification of pro football has bred an atmosphere of nihilism and greed in which players jump from team to team, teams jump from city to city, and fans pay through the nose and damn well like it. The old Cowboys had no agents, no business managers, no limousines waiting to take them to the practice field. After every game, they signed autographs for hours, without charge, of course. People felt like they knew them personally, and in some cases they did. Most of the players had regular jobs in the off-season. Landry sold insurance, and Meredith worked for a stockbroker. In 1958, the entire payroll of the 12-team NFL was $3 million, about what Cowboys defensive tackle Leon Lett was making before his drug suspension. There was loyalty to team and teammates unknown today, a willingness to sacrifice and a devotion to the game itself. It's ironic to remember that one of Landry's last top draft picks was Michael Irvin. Someone at the reunion asked Landry if he could coach today's game. "I probably could," Tom said, "but I wouldn't." A lot of us know that feeling.
We're at Texas Stadium in Dallas, Texas, a place of football history. We'll talk about that history with Tom Landry. Tell me your feelings when you were here for a Giant game and you looked up there and there was the Ring of Honor and your name was there and the hat was there. What was it like for you?
Well, it was really special, Charlie. I believe that the thing I enjoyed most was the seven Hall Ring of Honor guys coming back, Don Meredith and Roger Staubach and Bob Lilly and all the rest of them in there. You feel that closeness again that you only can get, coaching. Once you have that type of feeling with your team, it never goes away. And that was my greatest feeling, right, for the day. And it was nice. The hat was up there and on the ring, and it made it a special day for me, my family.
Does it bridge? I mean, this team, this new Cowboys under the ownership of Jerry Jones and the coaching of Jimmy Johnson, seems to have restored a spark with this community. Is your coming to this Ring of Honor, in a sense, the last bridge to bring the old and the new together?
Well, I hope so, Charlie. We had some wonderful fans, through all those years that followed the Cowboys. Some of them are not very forgiving, when something happens like that. But I think, as you say, it is bridging it. I mean, I think for the players, it becomes important. All we have, even as coaches, is the memories of those great years.
Here's an article from the April 2000 issue of Texas Monthly entitled, "We Remember Tom Landry." In the day after Tom Landry was buried in a private ceremony, his family, friends, and admirers gathered at the Morton H. Meyerson Symphony Center in Dallas to pay their respects to the longtime Dallas Cowboys coach, who succumbed to leukemia on February 12th at age 75. I arrived 3 hours early and took my place in line with people wearing dark suits and ties, sandals and shorts, and even the occasional Michael Irvin jersey. Once inside, I chatted with the man next to me, and we began elbowing each other when various stars took their seats. Sam Huff, Rayfield Wright, Tony Dorsett, Troy Aikman. When I asked him the ridiculous question of whether he had followed Landry's career, he turned to me and said, "I was born a fan." I knew exactly what he meant. I got to know Landry the way most people did, by watching him on television on fall afternoons. I grew up believing that the good guys wore stars on their helmets, and I thought that Landry was an honorable man because my dad thought he was. Yes, some people didn't like the Cowboys, but I figured they all lived in places like New York or Philadelphia. In the neighborhood north of Dallas, where I grew up, loyalty was a given. It still is. On the garage door of a house near my mother's home, someone has painted two silver football helmets with the familiar blue stars. In between them it says, "America's Team," "Cowboys," and 1992-93 World Champions, and 95. I fault the artist only for not including the other two seasons the Cowboys won at all, 1971 and 1977. But maybe he came to the neighborhood late. I wasn't even alive in January 1972 when Landry won his first Super Bowl, but I was there in January 1978, sitting cross-legged in front of the TV when the Cowboys beat the Denver Broncos for their second title. Like a lot of other kids, I idolized Roger Staubach, Billy Joe Dupree, Charlie Waters, and Ed "Too Tall" Jones. Even at age 5, though, I knew they were the world champions because of the man in the hat. Intense, reserved, and confident, Landry was a figure the entire state could be proud of. Born in the South Texas town of Mission in 1924, he led his high school to a regional championship in 1941. After that, he headed north to Austin, where he played football for the University of Texas. His time there was broken up by his service in World War II, and then on to New York, where he played and coached for two teams from 1949 to 1959. A conversation with Tex Schramm persuaded him to return to Texas and head up Dallas's fledgling team. He did so for 29 seasons, but his legacy isn't simply the number of games he won, 270. Only Don Shula and George Halas won more. Or the number of division titles, 13. Or the number of winning seasons, 20. Or even the number of Super Bowl victories, 2. He will be remembered for his character, his faith, and his impact on the city, whose image had been tarnished, fairly or not, by the assassination of John F. Kennedy. In his conservative suit and tie, he projected the qualities we so desperately wanted to be known for: intelligence, class, and above all, success. What made Landry even more interesting was how he handled defeat. Relentless in his desire for perfection on the field, and often criticized for the mechanical way he pursued it, he lost more championship games than he won. As much as the shotgun formation and the Hail Mary pass are part of the Cowboys' history, so are Bart Starr's quarterback sneak in the Ice Bowl, Baltimore's last-second field goal in Super Bowl V, and Jackie Smith's dropped pass in the end zone in Super Bowl XIII. Landry, though, was always ready to fight for another shot at the title. It was easy to be a fan during the 70s, but the 80s marked tough times for true believers. San Francisco's Dwight Clark made that catch in the back of the end zone in the 1981 NFC Championship game. In 1984, the Cowboys missed the playoffs for the first time in 9 years, and 2 years later they recorded their first losing season since 1964. In 1988, Landry won only 3 games, his worst record since his first year as the head coach. He recommitted himself to turning the team around, but people started talking about the future. One of my friends in high school, who had moved to the Metroplex just a few years before, insisted that Landry needed to go. But I didn't need someone from Indiana to tell me what was best. and I certainly didn't need a businessman from Arkansas to do so. It's hard to explain what it was like when Jerry Jones came to town in February 1989, firing the only coach the Cowboys had ever had. Sports writers would later point out that our collective outrage was lessened when he made the team winners again. But that misses the point. When Jones first took over, people hated him for dumping Landry so unceremoniously. As the years passed, they hated him simply for being himself. Perhaps that's the greatest irony of all. Landry, a real Texan, defied the stereotype of what we're supposed to be like, loudmouthed, egotistical, power-hungry, while Jones, an interloper, affirmed it. And who could have ever imagined that just 5 years after Landry left, Barry Switzer would stand in his place? This season, Dave Campo takes over as head coach of the Cowboys, and I wish him well, but he should know that he isn't filling Chan Gailey's shoes or Switzer's or even Jimmy Johnson's. He's filling Landry's. On the morning of the memorial service, I drove to Texas Stadium as a kind of pilgrimage because it symbolizes Landry more than anyone else. Hanging on the east side of the building was a huge photo of him, stern face, eyes burning with intensity, brim of his hat bent just so. When I turned to see what he was looking at, I saw downtown Dallas off in the distance. How fitting that he was watching the city he gave so much to. Professional sports are ultimately nothing more than a diversion, but Landry gave us something we needed, a home team to root for, a reason to feel like a community. I thought of the growing movement to rename the stadium after him, a notion that was first talked about in 1989. Given the value that naming rights command on the open market, I doubt it will happen. Still, the stadium will always belong to Coach Landry. As I was told over and over again growing up, God watched America's team through the hole in the roof. I can't help thinking that when the 2000 season begins, he'll have company.
Coach Landry was rather stiff and analytical, and Don was just the opposite of that. He was outgoing. He loved attention.
Where are you going to stick it?
Riding my yin-yang.
Don and I were much different. Our personalities were different. And, I mean, I always liked Don and I always feel warm for him today. And I don't know whether he feels the same about me today, but...
Colonel, thank you,
baby. He had a different outlook in football. He enjoyed football. He wanted to have a good time doing it.
Way to go, Turk. Way to go, buddy.
And I didn't feel like that's what made great quarterbacks. And that's where we conflicted.
At Navy, the freewheeling Staubach was encouraged to improvise. In Dallas, there was a system under the total control of head coach Tom Landry.
I did not fit his ideal of a perfect quarterback because I did run quite a bit, but he also saw that I would figure out how to win.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas. This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
AARP Foundation TaxAid is looking to expand its team of volunteers for the upcoming tax season. TaxAid, celebrating its 52nd year, offers free in-person preparation and assistance to anyone, especially those 50 and older, who can't afford a tax preparation service. Volunteers make a difference in their communities by assisting many older, lower-income taxpayers and their families who might otherwise miss out on the tax credits and deductions they've earned. Every level of experience is welcome. Volunteer tax preparers complete tax preparation training and IRS certification. The program is offered at senior centers in Odessa and Midland. Local information and details can be obtained by contacting Bob Schuler, District Coordinator at 432-362-7204.
This week on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Saturday Night Movie, we celebrate this weekend's big game with George Clooney's football film, Leatherheads.
Let me ask you a question. You like playing football?
I love playing football.
For a special breed of men called Leatherheads, the rules were simple.
You hit anybody that comes near him.
There were no rules.
Oh, I like him.
But when the game they love was going under...
We're broke now. Our season just started.
Time to pack it up and go home.
Dodge Conley had the plan.
It's your intention to legitimize professional football?
To build it back up.
Carter Rutherford leaves Princeton to play for the Duluth Bulldogs.
What?
You ever hear of Carter Rutherford, the Bullet?
War hero football boy?
They've got a completely different style, Carter. How are you going to adjust to that?
Maybe they'll just kind of adjust to me.
So you're a sports writer?
Why not?
Hey, what's a girl doing in a press box?
Certain jobs are always going to be done by men.
Big strapping man?
Now, two of football's biggest stars will find themselves competing.
The real story is the matchup between the Bullet and teammate Dodge Conley.
Over the one woman.
You're the kind of cocktail that comes on like sugar but gives you a kick in the head.
Who can throw them for a loss.
You think you're the slickest operator in Duluth. But being the slickest operator in Duluth is kind of like being the world's tallest midget, if you ask me.
It's too bad we know each other so well. We might have gotten along.
Well, I'll live.
Alone.
A couple of plays we ran at Princeton.
A lot of our plays are pretty strong.
These are a lot like your plays, only a little more effective.
Well, I've got some decisions to make.
In a minute.
Where were you two?
Out. Nowhere.
This spring.
Game of professional football has come of age.
That means rules.
We ain't never played any game clean.
Let the games begin.
Throw one.
You're the injured party. You get the first punt.
Leatherheads.
Stay away from my right knee.
Watch my left shoulder.
Also my right hindquarter.
Well, you wouldn't punch me in the back, would you?
Let's just go for the face.
You just hit me in the face.
George Clooney, Renee Zellweger, and John Krasinski star in the audio-described Leatherheads, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh.
That your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They seek the truth before they can die.
Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by. Them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry. So just look at them and sigh, and know they love you.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 53 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Make-believe ballroom. Let's dance. Romance at the tip of your fingers while the melody lingers. Let's dance, dance, dance. Just start in swaying while the band is playing. Music is worth your while. Let this station give you anticipation. Simply turn the dial and keep on dancing, though you've only a small room. Make it your ballroom. Let's dance.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. 5:30, Saturday evening, February the 3rd. My, oh my, 5 years have come and gone. For 5 years, we've been doing our level best to entertain you from the make-believe ballroom. But tonight, because you folks have all been so nice to us, we're here to bring you our 5th anniversary birthday party. And we're bringing it to you from the beautiful gold room of the Ambassador Hotel on Park Avenue in New York City. Everything is very quiet. Everybody's gathered around the loudspeakers, the microphones here in the room, just listening. But just so that you may know that it's really a party, meet our guests. I hope that our 5th anniversary party this evening is going to really serve to entertain you out there listening, and serve also as a means of thanking you for listening throughout these long, long years. Tonight, I should say this evening because it's early now, but we're going well into the night, I think you're going to find we've planned a mighty swell program for you. First, I'd like to introduce our guest of honor of the evening, and a little later on, I'm going to tell you why he is our guest of honor. It's none other than your favorite orchestra leader, and you've indicated that so many times, Mr. Glenn Miller.
Thank you very much, Martin. It's a pleasure for us to be here as your guest, and may we say that we heartily encourage your programs and think that you've been a great thing in the development of new bands, and you're the one that usually does the most talking, so I'm going to let you continue and we'll play the music.
Well, Glenn, that's swell of you to come over this evening and to bring the whole band and all of your vocalists. And consequently, I'm not going to take too much time talking. The folks here want to
dance. Hi, folks. I'm Jeff Bressler, and welcome to this week's edition of the Make Believe Ballroom. For those who are regular listeners, you might have noticed a little different opening this week as we listen to Martin Block, the original host of the ballroom, welcoming you to the 5th anniversary special of the Make-Believe Ballroom way back in 1940. February the 3rd of each year is the ballroom's anniversary. The first show taking to the airwaves of WNEW 1130 in New York in 1935. This February, 2021, being the 86th year since the start of the program, and with very few years' exception, it has been on continuously in one form or another since then. So, on today's program, a salute to the Make Believe Ballroom as we honor its founder, Martin Block. Also along the way, I am going to regale you with mostly music selections from that grand year of 1935. So let's indeed turn the clock back to 1935, where listeners to WNEW were awaiting developments in the tragic Lindbergh baby kidnapping. Martin Block, who was a staff announcer at the time, held the audience's attention by playing records between the Lindbergh news bulletins. Now this, what was considered innovative at the time, led to Block's show, Make Believe Ballroom. Now Block borrowed the concept and the title from West Coast-based disc jockey Al Jarvis. His idea was to create the illusion that the broadcast was from a ballroom with the nation's top dance bands performing live. So one day, Block left the studio, walked down the street, and he bought records from a local music shop since WNEW didn't have their own record library. Block walked up to the cashier, and he purchased five Clyde McCoy records, selecting McCoy's Sugar Blues for the radio show's initial theme song. And in doing so, Block became the first disc jockey in the city of New York. So let's listen to the first Make-Believe Ballroom theme. Here is Clyde McCoy and his orchestra with Sugar Blues, recorded in Chicago, January the 31st, 1935. Friends, I'm Jeff Bressler, and you're listening to my 86th anniversary celebration of the inaugural broadcast of the Make-Believe Ballroom. You could reach me at Jeff at MakeBelieveBallroomRadio.com, Jeff at MakeBelieveBallroomRadio.com. Now, it might sound to you like the Make-Believe Ballroom back in 1935 with a growing audience was a charmed program with smooth sailing ahead. But that indeed was not the case. Martin Block was called in on the carpet one day and told by the station sales staff that nobody would sponsor a radio show playing music. So he had to find a sponsor on his own if he wanted the make-believe ballroom to continue. Well, Martin Block, who spent time in sales prior to his radio career, found a company with the terrible name of Retardo, a diet pill manufacturer. They were